Good morning. I'm anxious today. I'm going to use a term from a Unitarian Universalist pulpit. There were no tomatoes out front there. That does not get used often. I have never used it, and I don't believe that I've ever heard the term used from the Unitarian Universalist pulpit that I've been in. And the term is faith commitment. And when I hear that term, if it weren't me speaking, I'd be on alert. What does this person mean, faith commitment? Because faith commitment, just that phrase, has been used as a bulwark to manipulate people, to hurt people. And if we go back far enough in history, if you didn't have a faith commitment to particular creeds and particular beliefs, you could lose your life, you could lose your place in community. And as we are going to work on this play, the expulsion of the UU community in Raquel in the 1500s, you could lose your home, your status, and everything you own if you weren't committed to this faith commitment, this set of beliefs that a community would hold dear. I'm a little less anxious. Nobody's left, so we're all right. But bear with me with that, because Crichton Payton and also Wyman, who he pointed us to in his conversations, they have a little different... Where are you going, Dave? They have a little different take on this phrase, faith commitment, than really that I have ever heard of. But it's one of those things, you don't know it, but when you discover it, you say, oh yeah, okay, well that makes sense. And it's enlightening and it's helpful, but until you get there, you don't know it. I also want to mention that sometimes in life we see final products, or we see somebody speaking, or we see the life of a person, and we think, wow, that's really significant, that's really great. But we really don't ask the question, well, how did they get there? What was their process of arriving there? And I can remember doing some clinical training for chaplaincy in my seminary days. And I had this supervisor, and we had to do a learning contract prior to the clinical training. And so you had to write down what you were going to learn, and then you'll be evaluated against the learning contract that you created. And, of course, was it negotiated and accepted. And at the end of one of those units, well, during the unit, I ran into some issues that were mine that had an impact on me that slowed me down in my learning process. So, which was the purpose of the clinical training at that point, was to point you to those places in your life that you might be having difficulties carrying on into the future that might interfere with your ministry. So it was a good process. So when it came time for the grading negotiation, you know, I just hung my head down low thinking, well, I didn't really fulfill my learning contract. And he said to me, but you did do this. You bumped into these issues and you were responsible in how you responded to that. And so you were in process. And then when he said that, I said, okay, I'll take two A's. that being the case. That was significant for me. Because what that meant was the process. And I really had not understood the difference between process and content. You know, kind of, but not really. But the process of transformation and movement with that particular person was valued, was cared for, was affirmed, and it even had weighed against those objective goals that I was so fierce and so felt so bad about not accomplishing. And so if you don't know that process about a person, you don't know how they got there. And so another story about a process. Here's a letter from Henry Nelson Wyman, who we're going to talk about, to Martin Luther King. And when we see Martin Luther King's life, we are seeing some of the work and ideas of Henry Nelson Wyman when we see Martin Luther King's life. If you want to know what Crichton Payton was talking about, the creative interchange, and that's Wyman's term, if you want to know what that looks like sociologically and politically, you look at Martin Luther King's life. And here's before Martin Luther King got on to his dissertation in the beginning of that process. And it's just a simple letter, but I thought I'd read it to you to give you some idea. Dear Mr. King, thank you for your letter of August 5th. It was delayed in reaching me because it had to be forwarded. I am teaching a summer session here. This is Henry Nelson Wyman to Martin Luther King. I know of only two writings that compare the theologian Paul Tillich with my own theology. And that was done by Horton in a volume by Tillich, edited by Kegley. Okay. Also, a few years ago, a student had done the same, and I've heard of people comparing my theology with other theologies. And I have a good deal of material not yet published, but cannot send you more than two pieces, partly because my manuscripts are at home, not here, but I am sending under separate cover two lectures that I have had mimeographed so that you can have them and you need not return them. I don't know if you've ever asked an author for a manuscript of something that hasn't been published yet, or you would like to read their ideas before they're out in the public. Often, they're kind of offended. But here we have a man, Henry Nelson Wyman, says, I will send these to you, and when I get home, I will get you more, whatever it is you need. And the reason I have called people that I've seen speak, theologians, and said, you know, I heard you speak on that, can you get me a copy of that? And they said, well, we're going to get that published, and I can't give you that now. And it was just a piece. So I have had the experience of that, and when I read that, something clicked. When I was talking to Crichton Payton, the speaker last week, emailed him about what he was going to talk about and told him I was interested in Wyman. He sent me the manuscript of a book yet published and said, here's what this is about. See, there's something about these two men and this term creative interchange, which they are willing to share and give of themselves, that's revealing about the concept they call faith commitment. In recent weeks, I have introduced a fourfold process of transformation, if you might remember. And if you don't, I'll remind you. That fourfold process was cultivating the ethic of the other, really becoming aware of the other person, their story, their history, so that when you relate to them, there's a fullness of your response to that other person, given the fullness of their story. And so that would become an ethical principle. Before you respond and relate to a person, you would want to know their story so that you could act in a sense of kindness and awareness. That was one. The other one was radical obedience, which is kind of an odd thing. And radical obedience was, in a way, trying to step out of your story so that you can look at your story and wrestle with your consciousness and your ethics, not in your story, but out of your story, and be obedient about what you hear when you're outside your own story. Kind of an odd thing, but very helpful as we learn to practice that. Letting go of inner blocks of true self-expression and intentionality of the space in between ourselves and others. Fourfold process of transformation. So you can imagine, when I got Payton's response and creative interchange, I thought, they're talking about the same thing that I'm talking about. I didn't know that I was asking you to do a faith commitment, but now that I know that, I guess I need to be honest about that's what that's about. And because this is a new way for me of wrapping my understanding of Unitarian Universalists around so that I can wrestle with it and it can have meaning in my life, I was reminded of my own personal journey in that got saved, fundamentalist Baptist church, and believed that transformation and spiritual growth was central through the person of Jesus, and came to realize that that phrase, the person of Jesus, was actually a set of symbols that reflected back on an understanding of a life of this man Jesus, and that there were symbols on top of symbols on top of symbols on top of symbols, and they weren't really about the person of Jesus. And then learned that that phrase, the person of Jesus, were also a set of symbols that pointed to the goddess Maat and Isis and the dark dark mother. But nonetheless, even realizing that new knowledge, and it was new knowledge for me as I went along in my pilgrimage, my commitment to spiritual growth and transformation and putting the person before creed and belief never changed. Consequently, I found myself in communities where I had difficulty because the beliefs, the creeds, the work toward the bureaucracies, the affirmation of the institutions, all of that came before, it seemed to me, came before the individual, came before the person. The person was sacrificed to the belief system. If the person didn't believe like us, they can't get financial help from us. If the person didn't believe like us, we can't share our resources with them if they don't believe like us, if they're not one of us. When you look at putting the person prior, before creed and belief systems, you don't ever come to the conclusion they're not one of us. When the person's first, you don't go there. When you use beliefs and creeds, when you use those as principles to guide us in life, that's one thing. But when those ideals, when those thoughts become supreme, the source of the supreme value, well, we have wars. We have them and we have us. And as Unitarian Universalists, we are curious in a way, because when we read our principles, democracy, justice, and we have separation of church and state, they're not secular terms. They're religious terms. Justice is a religious term. Democracy, in the way Wyman talks about it, and I'll read in just a minute, is a religious term. Democracy is to create space so that we can be free to sense who we are as human beings in any way we want, not abusive or hurtful to others, but to explore belief systems, to change, to grow, to shift, whatever it might be, without consequences. In the 1950s, Wyman writes, he's saying in the 50s what he sees in the culture is there's a decline in freedom. And he says that, I like to have ideals. To me, I like to think that from after World War II, at least till 1970, we had at least 30 good years of democracy. We had a strong labor movement, and I idealized that time. And there were good things, and people got pensions, and people got health care, and it resulted in the 60s of some wonderful social movements, kind of feeding off of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's Social Security and that kind of thinking. And so I read this and I think, oh man, that ideal just goes out the window. So it's kind of new knowledge. And well, just listen. Put into the decline of freedom, put into the most abbreviated form, the cause of this decline might be stated thus. The democratic peoples have come to interpret freedom in terms of private, local, competing, and transitory interests. They view democracy as a utility to serve these interests and to raise the standard of living. They do not recognize as commanding their ultimate allegiance a common good underlying these private interests and sustaining them. They do not recognize the prior claim upon their devotion of that development continuous through history, which creates freedom in social relations and in the mind of humanity. Having no such ultimate commitment, the democratic peoples identify freedom with social control exercised by changing desires, hates, and fears, which happen at any time to possess the mind of individuals and the voting majority. Under such conditions, the leaders of the democratic society, cannot command the great sacrifice for what preserves freedom when it demands run counter to the private interest and popular slogans. I'm thinking, he wrote this yesterday. He didn't write this in the 1950s. This results in a disastrous weakening of the power for concerted action in the struggle of dominance between freedom and tyranny. For Wyman, this is a theological and sacred issue. This prevailing state of mind makes it impossible for those in position of supreme command in the democratic societies to control the resources of the people according to knowledge, insight, and counsel available to them. They must deal with the problems, subtle, complex, extending through long periods of history. They must deal with these problems, but they must shape their policies and interpret their actions to conform to the demands of special interest and organized groups and transitory passions. They cannot protect and promote what creates a free society. They cannot, because they must shape their course of action to conform to the demands of minds which has neither understanding or compelling allegiance to the underlying vital needs of freedom. This is the predicament of democracies. So this was Wyman's view in the 1950s, that we as a democratic people, which he considers a theological and a religious issues, we are so committed to our transitory passions, to our immediate interest, to increasing our standard of living so I can have that boat in my driveway. We are so committed to that, we are unable to make the sacrifices to sustain a democracy through time. I think that's a pretty apt description of where we are today. So here's his answer. And here's what is kind of gripping me, at least willing to be here to talk about a faith commitment. Because his answer is a faith commitment to this. If freedom is to survive and grow under social conditions now developing, the commitment to creative interchange must be ultimate in the sense that nothing else can take priority over it. This ultimacy of the commitment is required for many reasons, and he's going to talk about a few. The commitment is to a process he has called the creative interchange. And hearing some of the responses of people last week to Crichton Payton's talking about creative interchange, for me, I want to clear up something first. The word creative cannot be used to describe darkness or evil or cruelty or clever ways in which we manipulate people. That is not creative. Creative always moves toward life. It is creative. It moves toward the light. There is a transparency to it. There's an openness to it. And the creative interchange ties directly into that concept of the ethic of the other, that we know the other person as we engage. When we think of Martin Luther King's life, when we think of that people will be judged by the character, not the color of their skin, that's a result of creative interchange, that the value of the person, it moves into the direction of a conversation and the character of who they are, not what they look like, not who they are, not my prejudices, but who they are, and how they behave in life. So what would that mean for Unitarian Universalists to have a faith commitment to creative interchange? What is scary about that? Because when I look at my life, I've been doing that all along. You get into pastoral counseling, psychotherapy, and you're looking for the transformation, you integrate theology. And my guess is many of us have had the experience that we want to be able to have a community that's safe and that's caring for one another. And we've also been doing it as a community all along. And when I look back at my sermons, I'm thinking, if not all, my sermons move in that direction of that creative interchange. How can we let go of the things that hinder kindness to myself and kindness to others? How can I move into the community with a sense of justice? We do that. What would be the resistance to a faith commitment, to a process a lot of us are already doing? And then I think, wait a minute, somebody would be able to ask me, what are you doing? I mean, is it accountability? I'm not, and I don't have the answer to this, but I am putting it out there to our community. I know that my experience in other religious traditions and communities, when they have a faith commitment to something, their behaviors begin to coordinate to that. For example, in the Southern Baptist community, and in my experience, when people said, we are a people of the book, the Bible, they spent a lot of their life energy looking at that book, looking at that Bible, trying to understand the Bible. When I look at the Buddhist community, and they talk about letting go of material things and letting go of images in life, they spend a lot of time in meditation letting go of things in their mind to be free of that. When they have this faith commitment to a particular thing, their behavior begins to coordinate to it. And that they are accountable to that process. And I think of Unitarian Universalists, we come from many different places and we've rejected the behaviors and the pressure that we have gotten from people to have a faith commitment, because if I don't show up, or if I don't do this, or I don't believe this way, or I don't have that creed, we're ridiculed and persecuted. And so we want to be in a place where that does not happen. But how do I have a faith commitment, not to a book, not to an object, not to a belief system, not to a creed, but a faith commitment to a process? A faith commitment to something that's perpetually changing and perpetually transforming, and it never really stands still. It's always, how do I bring myself, whatever feeling I have when something is sacred, or I have something I think that's really, that commands my attention and my energy. I don't know if you've ever had that experience. A few times in my life I have. One time when we drove through I-70 and I saw the eastern range of the Rocky Mountains for the first time, that was sacred. I stopped the car and had to get out and stood there for like 30 minutes just going, being from Chesapeake Bay area, we didn't see anything like that. That was sacred. I can remember at seminary, it was empty, and there's this one place in seminary where there's high ceilings, and when you stepped into that circle, that somehow commanded a feeling, a something. Going into cathedrals, I mean, it was a, you know, it's both man-made and nature commands a particular feeling. How does the process that's always in motion, that's transformation, how in the world would it command that feeling of sacredness, of reverence, of importance, to see that, to see it. How does that happen? How do I do that? So how would Unitarian Universalists, if we were not necessarily to say this is an absolute truth because anathema, but to say this is important to us? A faith commitment to creative interchange, to the space between us and others as individuals and as community, the space between this church and the community at large, that we consider this important. And for those of you who use the word sacred, that space and what happens in that space has the potential to be sacred. Is it sacred when the rose begins to unfold? Is it sacred when my son, there's the developmental stage, purposelessness play, and then purposeful play, and he was having matchbox cars and they were all over the place scattered. You know, let's pick them up, you know, that kind of thing. And then one day, all those cars were in line and in order. I went, what is that? That was the rose unfolding. That was him moving from one stage of development to the next stage of development. That was sacred. That was nature happening. That was evolution moving. A faith commitment to facilitate that process is what Wyman is talking about. Not just within myself. And I've had many experiences with myself and others. We do this imagery work where you see yourself as an inner child and see yourself as an adult and have the adult and your inner child come together. And it's good thing, but often in my own mind, my adult self, my inner child, we don't get along. It's hard to have an act of care there, and many of us are there. So that's a space in between. That's a sacred space between myself and you, between you and your partners. Those are sacred spaces. And how do we attend to that? And how do we be responsible to that? To us in the larger community. How does that work? And that's what Wyman is calling us to, an ultimate commitment to that where nothing else supersedes that. And if we supersede, and if ideals and creeds and beliefs become more important than that transforming process, he says, we are in trouble. Because then tyranny will set in. So today, I ask you to consider the meaning of faith commitment in light of something that's perpetually changing, perpetually growing. And how do we educate ourselves about that? How do we learn about that? How do we hold that process up with hands of care and gentleness? So that's what we're facilitating as a group of people.